Good morning. Our first case this morning is United States against Girard. Counsel for defense, you may proceed.
Please the court. I'm Tolman Finley, civilian counsel for Staff Sergeant Raymond Girard, the appellant. Staff Sergeant Girard respectfully requests that the court set aside his convictions for negligent homicide for three reasons. Because the invited error doctrine does not apply to this case, simply because there was no error invited by the defense. Second, even if the invited error doctrine did apply, it would not preclude reversal of his negligent homicide convictions, because there still must be an intentional relinquishment of a known right under the Supreme Court's ruling in the United States v. Alano. And finally, the conviction of Staff Sergeant Girard for negligent homicide as an LIO of premeditated murder is plain error under this court's previous ruling in the United States v. Jones. The invited error doctrine does not apply in this case.
Can I ask one question? If you're correct on one or all three of those, could your client, could the appellant be retried for negligent homicide?
Your Honor's asking essentially whether double jeopardy would bar for further prosecution. That's not an issue I've looked at, and I'm not comfortable saying one way or the other at this point. I think it might be possible. The invited error doctrine simply does not apply at the outset here, because in this circumstance, there are two critical things that are not disputed. The first is that negligent homicide is not an LIO of premeditated murder under the court's current law in light of Jones. The second issue that's not disputed is that at the time of Staff Sergeant Girard's court-martial in March of 2007, the law, and in fact the manual, were quite clear that negligent homicide was an LIO of premeditated murder. And it's that reason that makes this simply not an invited error case at all. This is not a situation where a defendant has come in and injected a proverbial time bomb into the case so that they have an issue in their back pocket for appeal should a conviction result. Staff Sergeant Girard didn't ask for larceny or some completely far afield offense to be instructed on. He didn't himself propose an instruction misstating the burden of proof or an element of the offense or making some other clear error under the then controlling law. He didn't himself elicit evidence of an involuntary statement in cross-examining a witness. So this is not a situation where the accused has brought in an error under the controlling law. Instead, this is a situation where everybody, the military judge, the defense, and the government were operating under their understanding of what was at the time very clear law that negligent homicide was an LIO of premeditated murder. In fact, the military judge was required to instruct on all LIOs, even sua sponte, had Staff Sergeant Girard not even requested this. So this is really not a situation at all where the defendant is injecting some defect into the proceedings. There was no error actually at the time under the then controlling law. So the government's case that they cite, Spivey from the Fourth Circuit, is an opposite for that reasons, because there you have a situation where the defendant had asked for an instruction.
Counsel, isn't Jones really a notice case? And in a situation like this, it's hard to argue that your client didn't have notice. Well, when he requested the instruction and he briefed it, so where does that leave us?
Well, in Jones, the notice comes into play at the end of Jones, end of the plain error analysis, which is separate and apart from invited error.
I'm not talking about invited error. I'm talking about notice.
I understand. With the Sixth Amendment issue that comes into play here in terms of the substantial rights that would be affected by the plain error, generally speaking, with respect to the notice comes from the statute in the ordinary course. In the unique situation of Article 134 offenses, the court has recognized that in that context, the notice really should come from the language in the specification. There's no source to look for that here. There's,
didn't the notice come from the manual?
Well, that's actually a good point. There is no more or less notice to Staff Sergeant Girard in this case than there was in Jones, because it is in the manual as a lesser included offense. But if that sufficed for notice, then Jones had notice too, because indecent acts was listed in the manual as a lesser included offense of rape, which Jones was charged. In this case, the case was not tried as a negligence case. Government put on no proof of standard of care. They didn't call an expert to talk about what Staff Sergeant Girard should have done.
But that's not really my question. He asked for the instruction. He briefed it, right? So where are we with regard to notice?
Well,
you're trying to distinguish it from Jones.
I don't think it's distinguishable from Jones.
It is Jones. Okay.
Yes, it's no different from Jones.
Okay.
And in fact, in Jones, it's a little different. Jones didn't argue that he didn't have notice, of the offense. In fact, he said, it's right there in the manual. Jones objected to. Yeah, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
Counsel, why isn't it significant that he affirmatively asked for this instruction, and in doing that, you have to assume that he was aware of the consequences?
Well, there's a difference between knowingly requesting an instruction under the then controlling law as set forth in the manual and taking full advantage of the law as it existed at the time versus what he did not have knowledge of, and counsel did not have knowledge of, was that, in fact, negligent homicide was not a valid LIO.
And that's fine, but let's assume you're right that it wasn't waived, that it wasn't invited error, and let's assume that you're right that it was error and that it was plain and obvious. And then we get to whether or not it was prejudicial.
Yes, sir.
And in looking at whether it's prejudicial, we determine whether or not he had notice, and so that he could prepare for it. Well, you're right. It wasn't in the pleadings, but he asked for it. And so if he asked for it, it's pretty hard to argue that he wasn't on notice that this was going to become an issue and that he could be convicted of it. And that's the problem I have as to the prejudicial analysis.
Well, it's important to note that Staff Sergeant, this issue came up at precisely the same point it came up in Jones. And not prior, after the close of evidence, from both sides, and just prior to charging. Nothing in the specification, nothing in the statute. It's there as an LIO in the manual, for sure. But that clearly, under Jones, is not sufficient to establish notice. The fact that he requested it is indistinguishable for the important reason it's important to note what Jones did and did not object to and what he did and did not agree to. In Jones, the only objection that was ever articulated to the LIO was that it wasn't related to the evidence. Jones never argued and, in fact, affirmatively agreed with the military judge that indecent acts was an LIO of rape in that case. And once after the judge read the instruction to the jury, and asked if there was any objection, counsel said none. So, affirmatively agreed that it was an LIO, and any objection that he may have had, he waived in any event by not renewing it after the instruction had been read. So, there's really no distinction. And the only distinction you can get to is the fact that he affirmatively asked for it, which is why the government is arguing invited error. But the point I started out making is that this is really indistinguishable from what ordinarily is your invited error context, which is where it's actually an error at the time under the control
of
law.
What's the purpose of the invited error doctrine? What's the theory behind it?
I think the theory behind it is to prevent exactly what I referred to at the outset. A creative lawyer essentially throwing an issue into the case to have in the back pocket if things don't come out right. And knowing what the law is, or at least in the situation where they should have known, where it was clear by prior rulings or the statute, proposing an instruction that omits an element or misstates an element, misstates the burden of proof, something like that that they make, then turn around and complain about. Here, everything was in accordance with the controlling law at the time.
And how would you categorize or define the case law in invited error? Do you think it all points in one direction? Does it point in different directions? Is it clear, confusing?
I think it's pretty clear.
It's like both sides point to different cases. And so I guess the backhanded question is, what's the best case supporting your position that invited error requires an error? And what's frankly the worst case that you need to deal with?
Well, the best case, they start with the Supreme Court's ruling in Alano, which revisits plain error makes clear the distinction between forfeited error and waived error, and makes clear that a waiver, which is what would preclude review, requires an intentional relinquishment of a known right. That's the best case. After that is the Ninth Circuit's en banc decision in Perez, which is cited in the briefs, where the Ninth Circuit specifically reconsidered their invited error precedent in light of Alano, and because the Supreme Court had made no distinction between whether the error was requested, acceded to, or simply not objected to by the defendant.
What's the government's best case, and how do you deal with it?
The best case the government has cited is the unpublished Spivey decision from the Fourth Circuit, which would not even be binding precedent in that jurisdiction right now. And that case, in a very cursory fashion, cites Perez and considers Alano and finds it makes no. Alano doesn't change the Fourth Circuit's prior invited error precedents, but there's an important oversight in the Spivey case by the Fourth Circuit, and that's that they cite Alano and then say, well, invited error is the same thing as waiver. They're one and the same. So, you know, it's waived.
Finish answering, Jason.
What the Fourth Circuit overlooked was the fact that Alano was very clear in what a waiver is. It's an intentional relinquishment of a known right. And the Fourth Circuit never addressed, okay, well, it's invited, so maybe it's intentional. But they never addressed whether there was any sort of known right that was being waived, whether the defendant knew about it, whether it was even clear from the controlling law at the time, such that there could be a basis for an inference that the defendant knew about it and was giving up any right. So without anything in the record the Fourth Circuit just conflates invited error and waiver and never actually gets to the ultimate waiver issue under Alano. Yes, ma'am.
Counselor, under Harcrow, what law are we applying here today?
Your Honor, I think it's simply plain error doctrine is what controls this case. I don't think invited error is applicable, so we just go through the plain error analysis just like was done in Jennings.
Well, I understand, but when we're deciding whether any error was, whether it was error or forfeiture, are we looking at what the law was at the time of trial, or are we looking at what the law is today?
The law is at least on a case on direct appeal, the law is that the court looks to whether it's plain sitting here today from the law.
And what would be the effect of holding or considering that for purposes of the invited error doctrine that we look at the law as it was then as opposed to the law as it is today?
Well, why you look to the law then is that's going to whether it was intentional and whether it was a knowing relinquishment of a right, which is what's required for constitutional waiver. So it's important what was in the head then. I think Your Honor pointed out in your opinion in Harcrow that this all relies on a little bit of plain error doctrine relies on a little bit of a fiction. In that a series of fictions. And in this context, one of those fictions is that it was actually an error at the time. You know, and under the controlling law, the military judge did the correct thing, and he would have been deviating from controlling law had he held otherwise at the time. But the intervening authority makes clear that, okay, that was an error, even though he did the right thing at the time, but it's still on direct review, so it can be corrected. And So there is a little bit of tension, but it's because of the legal fiction that's kind of built into the speaking about what is the courts understand to be a plain error.
Counsel, let's step back from the fictions of an error that's not an error at the time and an error that's not invited at the time, but use the plain error test. And that is the third prong of a plain error test on the question of prejudice. And why is this case not distinguishable from Jones in the following respect? In Jones, the military judge identified what the military judge thought to be the lesser included offense, and the defense acquiesced in the judge's ruling. Here, the judge said to the parties, what's the state of the law? Is there a lesser included offense? The government responded in the negative. Government didn't want a lesser included offense here. The defense said, yes, there is, and the judge asked the defense for a brief, and the defense affirmatively provided a brief arguing for the lesser included offense. For purposes of the prejudice prong, whether it's notice or a generalized understanding of what was going on at the trial, why does that not diminish the remove the prejudice under the third prong? That is, we'd find that there's error, that the error was plain under the fictional standard, as you've described it. But in terms of prejudice, given the active involvement in the defense in seeking here, why isn't that prejudicial?
Well, in addition to what I've pointed out before, that there's a Sixth Amendment notice right, there's the fact that it was completely tried as a premeditated murder case, not as a negligence case. Government's opening and closing arguments were all exclusively devoted to that. There's gaps in the evidence based on the fact it wasn't tried as a negligence case. There's also prejudice to the accused already Article 32 rights because, just like the grand jury clause in the Fifth Amendment, the accused has the right to have an offense looked at by an IO, considered whether there's evidence to support elements of the offense, and then the convening authority passing on that before any charges are referred. Well, here, that's okay in the ordinary course if something is a valid LIO, because the elements are a subset of the greater offense. Therefore, if the IO is passed on the elements of that greater offense, then necessarily he's looked at the lesser included offense, even if he's not specifically preferring charge on that. But if it's not an LIO, there's no guarantee the IO ever looked at any of this, ever thought it considered any evidence was pertaining to negligence, and ever passed or even considered that possibility.
Why then wouldn't the defense counsel have said at the time that the government said no LIO, then say, we agree, we'd be in bad shape if we had an LIO here? In terms of prejudice, all those issues that you've raised about the investigating officer and the manner in which the case was tried, here we had a situation in which there wasn't going to be an LIO if the defense agreed with the government, unless the judge somehow imposed it at that point. But instead, the defense used this as an opportunity not simply to acquiesce, but to affirmatively argue for the LIO. Doesn't that remove the prejudice from those previous issues that you've raised?
I don't think so, because at the end of the day, he's still convicted of something that was not a valid LIO.
I understand your argument.
And I think I understand where the court's coming from, and the tension is this conflation of invited error plain error review. And the fact that the accused requested it, at least in the circumstance where it was valid apparently under the controlling law and as stated in the manual at the time. I mean, if the accused is going to trial and says, well, the judge says, well, what LIOs do you want instructed on? Open up the manual and look, there's attempt, and in this context there's negligent homicide. So, let's ask. That's kind of the situation that's presented here. Is the manual clearly stated at the time that was an LIO. So you run down the list and that's what you ask for.
Counsel, I think you've made those points, and I don't want to cut you off, but unless you have something additional to add that you haven't said before in response to my question, you'll have an opportunity on rebuttal.
All right. If there are no other questions, I will then reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal. And reiterate to the court that Staff Sergeant Girard requests that the court set aside the convictions on specification three, charge three, specifications 1 through 3, and return the record to the convening authority for a new hearing on the sentence in light of the change in the sentence in the schedule.
Thank you.
Retrial and findings, or are you saying as a matter of law, or that's just what you prefer?
If the convictions are set aside, Staff Sergeant Roy's position would be that the that changes the sentencing landscape and such as to require
But are you asking us to do it in a manner that would not allow the convening authority to recharge negligent homicide?
As I said, Your Honor, I apologize to the court. I was not intending the request for relief to necessarily preclude that if that's what the law would or would permit.
Chair.
Thank you, counsel. You have a further opportunity on rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Chief Judge Efron. May it please the court. My name is Major Adam Kazin. I, along with Lieutenant Colonel Jan Albert-Kevich, represent the United States in this matter. A key component of appellant's argument is that the government did not present or argue appellant's case on a theory of negligent homicide. And the government is in complete agreement that was not the government's theory of trial. And the reason is that that was the defense's theory of trial. Negligent homicide was part of the defense's case. It was their alternative theory on whether or not Sergeant Girard was guilty of the premeditated murders and the conspiracy to commit murder. And it was first injected by the defense when they requested the instruction, but beyond that, it was also argued by the defense during closing.
Well, counsel, based on the state of the law at that time, including the listing of negligent homicide as an LIO in the manual for court-martial, wasn't that the only prudent thing for a defense counsel to do to avoid being ineffective?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. There were several strategic choices defense counsel could have made.
But what I'm suggesting is, under the state of the laws that existed at the time of the trial, wasn't that a perfectly reasonable, plausible, necessary alternative theory for the defense to pursue?
Yes, Your Honor.
But if the law then had been what it was today, can you say that the defense would have taken the same course of action?
They might have, Your Honor.
But can you say that they would have, or that even if, that they could have, if it wasn't an LIO?
I would say that
without requesting an amendment to the charge sheet.
Yes, sir. I would say that yes, they would probably pursue that because it was clear the defense does not want an all or nothing case. Whether it's today or yesterday, it was a question of whether or not there was going to be an all or nothing or some sort of backup plan for the defense.
Can you say to a certainty that if it had been an all or nothing case, that they would have been convicted of the greater offense that they were actually charged with?
I think we can say that the negligent homicide
because they weren't convicted of that, were they?
I would agree with that, Your Honor, and that's really the case with any time there's an LIO issue. But the Supreme Court and this Court have recognized the inherent benefit that lesser included offenses have to the defense, and it's not so much an argument for a compromise verdict or something along those lines. What it allows the defense to do, and what the defense actually did in this case, is to compare and contrast the instructions.
But the question of whether there's an inherent benefit of an LIO doesn't answer the different question of whether it was an LIO, does it?
No, Your Honor, it doesn't. But it goes towards this invited error, and I'm sort of directing this towards invited error, is invited error, the doctrine, is a little bit of a misnomer in that the courts don't actually look to whether the underlying claim is an error at all. It's invited alleged error. But the case I would first point to is the Benefield case, the Fourth Circuit case in 2002. It's a published Fourth Circuit opinion. And it said that this was an issue of the accused said that the judge erred in a simple possession instruction on an LIO to a possession with intent to distribute. And what the court said was, we need not address whether the instruction constituted error, however, because any error was clearly invited by Benefield. So With this case and what we see in other cases is that the courts don't address the underlying
error. So you're saying that there's uniform case law, all the case law points in one direction, that there need not be an error?
I would not say uniform, Your Honor. I would say the great weight of
the
authority.
Are there cases on either side of the ledger there?
The only one that would support the defense's point of view would be the Perez case that they cited out of the Ninth Circuit, where the Ninth Circuit sort of took Alano, and Alano was not addressing invited error, and they added an extra requirement to the invited error doctrine that essentially eliminated the invited error doctrine as we know. Invited error doctrine in the Ninth Circuit is essentially an affirmative waiver doctrine. And what we've seen through the courts is that invited error and affirmative waiver are related but separate concepts. They're not the same thing.
Counselor, without disputing that, if we assume that Alano remains good law, and if we assume that our case in Harpo, the majority opinion in Harpo, which I didn't disagree with, is also correct state of the law, how can those cases logically exist and maintain validity if you can avoid them by using the invited error doctrine to basically circumvent them? By saying, well, even though we look and apply the law as it is today for purposes whether there was a way for a forfeiture or plain error at all, it was invited error because even though the law was what it was then, not what it is now, they requested it based on what the law was then.
Well, Your Honor,
do you understand my question?
I mean,
how can those concepts logically coexist?
I think there's one is and I think what you, your concurring opinion described as the curious intersection between retroactivity and plain error doesn't apply to the invited error doctrine and because they're looking at different interests. What invited error is really looking at is who induced the action. It's about inducement of the military judge or just the district court judges in many of the federal cases. And so it doesn't get into the underlying, do we apply the law at the time today or do we apply the law at the time then?
But if the action is invited based on what the law was then, but we have to look at whether there was error or whether it was a problem based on what the law is now, don't you see that as a problem?
I don't, Your Honor, because that's why I say that invited the idea that the term invited error is a little bit of a misnomer. They don't look to whether or not there was an error or not. It might have been an error.
So you don't think that we should ask the question if the law had been what it was, what it is today at that time, would they have asked for the action that they invited?
I don't think we asked that question, Your Honor. And the case that we cited as sort of illustrative of that, and we understand it's not binding precedent, is the Tenth Circuit case, Riggins. And it's illustrated because the facts are so very similar. In that case, there was the accused was charged with bank robbery, and the defense affirmatively requested the LIO, what they called an LIO, of bank larceny. At the time, the Tenth Circuit had ruled that bank larceny was, in fact, an LIO. It was an unsettled question in the Supreme Court. 2 days after Riggins was convicted of the bank larceny offense that the defense counsel requested, the Supreme Court ruled in a different case that it wasn't an LIO. So they directly overturned the precedent on which the defense counsel based his decision to ask for that LIO. And so when it came on post-conviction review, the Tenth Circuit did what the Fourth Circuit does and what the other circuit says. We don't look at whether or not, in fact, it was very clear that it wasn't an LIO. And they didn't ask the question, would you have asked for something different if the case law had changed, because they said the not only the defense counsel asked for it, they used it. This was part of their theory. And that, Your Honor, yeah, Judge Baker, you asked about what is the purpose of the invited error doctrine. It's not to ferret out defense counsel doing nefarious things. They don't look at whether or not the motives were evil on the defense counsel's part or whether he was purposely kept error. What they look at is who induced the action. And
was the judge required to give an instruction on the law at the time on the LIO?
It was certainly only based on the defense counsel's argument.
Are you arguing then that there was not legally sufficient evidence to prove negligent homicide?
Not at all, Your Honor.
Well, if there's legally sufficient evidence, wasn't there some evidence that would require an LIO instruction to be given?
It wasn't identified, but it was identified by the defense.
And there was some evidence that the LIO was in play under the law at the time. Was the judge required to give the instruction?
Under the rules, yes, Your Honor. He would have been required to give
instruction. So he's invited an error on something the judge was required to do in any event?
Not necessarily, Your Honor, because it required an argument as to how the evidence worked. And the defense counsel said, did this on closing, is how did the evidence of negligent homicide, the government certainly didn't identify it. the evidence was there, but it wasn't seen, and it wasn't identified. It was identified by...
So he's in a box, so the judge doesn't give the instruction he's required to give, and then you argue waiver or forfeiture or whatever the thing is. So you've got it. It seems like it's a lose-lose for him. He either invites the error or he waives it if the judge doesn't give it. So the only thing that would work through this paradigm is if the judge sui sponte gives it while the defense says nothing.
Well, it just changes the analysis, Your Honor. It changes the burdens. We're not saying that you know, when we look at, we have these three different doctrines, the forfeiture, the affirmative waiver, and the invited error. They, different circumstances trigger different burdens. If the judge doesn't give the instruction, the court, and the court thinks it was required, it's reviewed for plain error because the defense didn't ask for it. But if the judge did give the instruction, I mean, it's a shifting burdens, and that's the state of the law. And so we look to, and again, that's what distinguishes this case from Jones. So the fact is, it does matter to the courts whether someone asked for something or someone didn't ask for something. It simply matters. And so in this case, we haven't had different facts than we had in Jones. In this case, we have affirmative action by the defense counsel to request the instruction. And so that changes the analysis. Because what invited error, and Judge Kleinfeld in his concurring opinion in Perez talked about it, what invited error really is talking about is the accused's right to complain. It's hard for the accused to complain if it was everything that he wanted and everything he utilized. Because what we have here is that the panel, from all evidence in the record, bought into the defense's theory. And I point this out because if you look at the record at page 1713, in the closing argument, it was the defense counsel that utilized, and I'm sorry, this is not in the joint appendix.
It's not in your brief either, is it?
No, Your Honor, I apologize, it's not. It's something that's, that we, as we went through oral argument or practices, we identified.
So what did the counsel say in the closing
words
argument?
Words of the counsel were, quote, this is where the instructions of negligent homicide come in. And then they went on to talk about, it was in the context of talking about the testimony about the meeting. And the government's theory was that the meeting between the accused and his squad was the evidence of the conspiracy, the evidence of the premeditation for murder. And what the defense counsel countered in this part is saying, that's evidence of negligent homicide. He said, this is negligent homicide. There was a duty. He knew that Hunsacker and Claggett wanted to kill these guys, and he sent them off with him anyway. That's negligent homicide. And so it was used as the comparing and the contrasting of negligent homicide versus the premeditated murder. So they identified it in regards to the government's theory and their alternative theory. And clearly by their verdict, they bought into the government's theory, the defense theory. Because the government countered that they didn't want negligent homicide. They thought this was premeditated murder. And so the defense can't complain that the panel bought into their argument.
And it's the government's theory that the... Excuse me, General.
No, go ahead.
It's the government's theory that the judge was not required to give the instruction because the evidence didn't raise negligent homicide. Is that your theory?
No, Your Honor. The government was silent at trial.
No, I'm talking about now. My understanding of your response to Judge Baker, but maybe I misunderstood it, was that the judge was not required sua sponte to instruct on negligent homicide because the evidence didn't raise it.
Well, the evidence, the defense pointed out what evidence they, because the evidence can be raised, it can be the government's evidence or it can be the defense's evidence. And so the government did not identify the evidence, the defense did. And so the government went along with it. I mean, the government sort of...
What's the government's position now? Was the judge required to give the instruction sua sponte because the evidence raised negligent homicide?
The judge, if they're applying the law at the time, then the judge, once the defense identified what the evidence was, that there's some evidence, then yes, the judge would have been required.
So you agree that there was some evidence of negligent homicide in the case that required the judge to give that instruction?
That was identified by the defense, yes, Your Honor. I think that it changes when
the judge is asleep in the case and doesn't identify the evidence themselves?
Not at all, Your Honor. Oftentimes the judge will ask, in fact, we encourage the judges to ask the parties, what things do you see? Because I don't necessarily see everything. As the judge, I may see the evidence differently than the defense counsel and the prosecution may see. And so, again, it would be a different situation if the judge was doing his sua sponte duty to advise on negligent homicide. But when you're looking at whether or not it's error or not, it matters whether or not that error was induced, the alleged error was induced by the defense. Because the defense now is claiming that the judge, applying the law at the time now, should not have given it. So we're left with the question of, well, how did this negligent homicide theory get before the panel? Whether the judge was required to or not, it's clear that the only reason why the judge instructed on it was because the defense requested it.
The judge would have been in error at the time, under the law at the time. In other words, if the defense didn't request it, nobody said anything, and if we were under the law at the time, wouldn't it have been error for the judge not to instruct sua sponte because the government now agrees that there was evidence in the case of negligent homicide?
Well, we'd be in a very, it's hard to answer because we've been in a very different situation. One is that if he had instructed on it, he obviously wouldn't have been convicted of it. But if he had instructed on it, it would have been under a plain error analysis if they're saying it was error not to instruct on it. So we flipped the entire case.
No, if he had been convicted of another offense and the defense came up here and complained that there was a failure to instruct on negligent homicide based on the judge's sua sponte duty, wouldn't that have been error at the time?
It would have been analyzed under a plain error if the defense had not requested it and the judge had failed to. We would have been under a plain error. And
you do think there's legally sufficient evidence in the record to convict on negligent homicide, however?
Yes, Your Honor. And we
okay, but and somehow there's not some evidence to require an instruction, but there's legally sufficient evidence.
And Your Honor, I don't think I would say that there wasn't some evidence. It was simply that the evidence that would have supported the conviction was identified by the defense rather than the prosecution. It's odd. I don't doubt that. But it's the same thing that happened in these other LIO cases that we pointed out in our brief, where the defense throws in a theory and it's sort of used as a magnet to draw the panel away from the greater offense into the lesser offense, and then complains that that never should have been instructed in the first place.
But the counsel, I hate to interrupt you,
yes, sir,
but you're relying primarily on Benefield and Riggins, right, to support your theory of invited error?
Well, I would start in the hierarchy of things. I would start with this Court's own precedent in Dingus and Rea, where there is an invited error doctrine that's applied. So,
but do any of those cases discuss what the situation that we have here? I mean, even if the situation was the situation, do they discuss the intersection of Olano and plain error and waiver and forfeiture and the difference in perspective with respect to the law? Because it seems to me that the Ninth Circuit opinion is the only one that does.
Well, the Ninth Circuit opinion, Your Honor, it misapplies Olano in our opinion. But
at least recognizes that it exists and that there's an issue there.
Well, I think the Spivey case that we cited, it is an unpublished Fourth Circuit case, but they it was interesting that in the Ninth Circuit in Perez, they relied very heavily on the Fourth Circuit, saying, well, the Fourth Circuit agrees with us that Olano changes the landscape. But then you have Herrera in 1994, and you have Benefield in 2002, both post-Olano cases, where they don't apply Olano in the way that Perez says that the Fourth Circuit's applying. So it's kind of interesting that the Ninth Circuit relied on the Fourth Circuit for that. And then you get into the Spivey case, where, yes, it's an unpublished opinion, but it specifically addresses Perez and that argument about Olano and says that's not how invited error it works. I'd also point there's other cases, the state court case, Roe versus Commonwealth, it's a Virginia case, where the government actually conceded during argument that it's not an LIO, and the court continued to say, we don't look at whether or not it's an error or not, we're looking at whether or not it was induced.
So, counsel, just to be clear, in the government's mind, is there any difference between these two situations? One, back in whatever year this case was tried, where the manual for court martial and the law say that negligent homicide is an LIO, the accused requests an instruction for LIO, or the military judge sua sponte gives one, okay? And situation two, we're here today, and let's say that we've decided it is not an LIO. And nonetheless, the appellant requests an erroneous instruction, requests an LIO for negligent homicide, and the military judge, either because he doesn't like Jones or because he just doesn't know the law, gives the instruction. The appellant is convicted of negligent homicide and then comes up here and complains because the LIO was given. Okay? You don't see any difference between those two scenarios?
Well, the scenarios...
In terms of the invited error doctrine, Olano, et cetera, et cetera.
What I would say, Your Honor, was that if the defense requests the instruction, that's the key, I think, component between the two examples. If the defense requests instruction, then none of the rest matters.
So your answer is that the government sees no difference in between those two scenarios?
Not for purposes, and that's where we have a clear-cut case of where the defense is requesting the instruction. It's not, there, a lot of the situations that they talked about, what Alana was really talking about, was we sometimes have ambiguity. There's the ambiguity of did he request it, did he not request it, was it acquiescence, was it not acquiescence. That's where Alano really came in and talked about the distinction between affirmative waiver and waiver by forfeiture. And Alano was not talking about invited error. In fact, Alano's never addressed invited error, and invited error is a doctrine that exists within all the circuits. The only one that's sort of gone off on its own little way is the Perez case. And he even talked, in Alano talked about whether a particular right is waivable, whether the defendant must participate personally. All those things are determined on a case-by-case basis. And so if there was some sort of ambiguity, if there was some sort of, it's not entirely clear whose idea it was, and then there might be something different. And that is really what distinguishes invited error from affirmative waiver. With invited error, it matters more whose idea it was. When it's the government's idea, if you do the scenario where the government came up with the idea of the instruction and the defense acquiesced to it with plain error, if the government came up with the idea and the defense said, we want it too, we're looking at affirmative waiver. But when it's the defense's idea, we're into the invited error, and it's done under a different analysis.
In the Article III courts, the district courts, are they required sua sponte to instruct on all lesser-included offenses?
Off the top, I do not know, Your Honor.
Let's assume that that's not the case.
Yes, Your Honor.
Does that distinguish all the precedents that have been cited from those courts from the situation we had before us, where what would be the duty of any counsel as an officer of the court if the judge says, do you see a lesser-included offense here? Wouldn't it be the duty of every counsel, irrespective of whether it benefited their client or not, to give the judge the accurate answer on that matter?
Are you talking about our courts or in the other
courts? Our courts.
It certainly would if the defense or the government saw something that they believed was a lesser-included offense. But it doesn't necessarily mean that the defense has to so affirmatively request or utilize that instruction.
Understand.
So it's not simply just, like I said, it's not simply just the request. It's also what the courts look to. I see my time is up.
You can answer that question.
It's also to the how it was used and how it was utilized throughout the process, and that all affects the analysis of whether or not it was invited or induced. And so whether or not, and Your Honor, in conclusion, if there are no further questions. Whether it's invited error, whether it's plain error under a three-part prompt test, it all leads to the same place. The fact that the accused requested it either invites the error, which requires no further analysis, or at the very least eliminates any type of argument for prejudice, because you can't be prejudiced if the idea was your own. You can't be, you said you had no notice and no opportunity to prepare a defense if it was your own theory. The government has no way of presenting, no way of putting the defense on theory of the defense's own, the government has no way of putting the defense on notice of the defense's own theories.
So, but just to be clear, the government wouldn't concede that there's at least the potential for prejudice if the LAO should not have been given at all, and if it had not been given, they can't say he would have been convicted of anything.
I don't think we can say that, Your Honor, because, I think that the LIO changes how things went, because, for example, if a person was convicted of premeditated murder and the judge failed to give a lesser-included offense instruction, that can be error that can reverse the conviction. So the argument that, well, he was convicted of the greater, so we don't have to worry about any of the lessers, that would make a failure to give a lesser-included offense instruction never a prejudicial error. So we have to assume, as the courts always have, that the instruction on the lesser-included offense had an impact on the trial. And it clearly did, because I said it allows the defense to make arguments and theories to the panel that they otherwise wouldn't have been able to make. They wouldn't have been able to contrast.
Okay, you're not answering my question, you're repeating your arguments. That's fine.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. You may briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. For those reasons, Your Honor, we ask that the court properly affirm the findings and sentence in this case. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, very briefly, Your Honor. First, the fact remains that Staff Sergeant Gerard was convicted of a crime with which he was not charged, which was not set forth in the specification, for which evidence was not presented by the government, and which he did not defend it against during the case in chief. Came up only after the case had closed. First of all, the court, I believe, is correct that the military judge is the ultimate authority on this. He gets to decide, and he has the duty to decide what LIO offenses should be instructed on, what shouldn't, and if it's raised by the evidence, he's obligated under Rule for Court Martial 920 to give the instruction.
Can we tell from the record whether the issue of the LIO was first raised by one of the parties, or was it first raised by the judge, or did it happen in one of these mysterious 802 sessions where nobody knows what happened?
I believe, if I'm going from memory, it came up in an 802 session. I wasn't there at the trial. My understanding.
Not asking you to testify. I'm asking what the record. Don't want you to testify. What does the record show in this case as to who, if anyone, initiated the discussion of LIOs?
I think the military judge initiated the discussion in an 802.
Does the record
about
show
LIOs generally?
Yeah.
As to what LIOs should be charged.
Are you speculating, inferring, or are you citing to a page in the record?
No, that's my recollection.
We can check the record on that.
So 802, 39A session. I apologize.
So it was in a 39A session at the military.
And I think if you look at Joint Appendix 161, through 160, is this the one? Yes. Yes, it's Joint Appendix 161, where the court asked the parties what lesser included. Counsel, what if starts with the government? What lesser included offense do you see?
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
It's from there. But it is correct that it was the defense who requested the negligent homicide LIO, but it was the military judge who initiated the discussion. And I believe that the court is correct that that is a point of distinction in the civilian context. I actually had to be educated on this point by detailed counsel. In the military context, that the judge would be required to give all LIOs raised by the evidence. I don't think that's the case in the civilian context. It's within the discretion of the trial judge, although the defendant can waive the LIO, assuming it's an intentional relinquishment of no right established in a colloquy. Very briefly.
Counsel, although your time has expired,
yes,
you can take the time you need to make the point you need to make on rebuttal and briefly conclude.
I don't want to belabor any of the points. I will point out the authority the government is relying on. They mentioned briefly REA, which is the only military court cited error case they cited. That was actually an evidentiary issue in that case, where the defendant had brought out something in cross that they then objected to and raised as error on appeal, and it's a very cursory invocation of the invited error. And as I understand the government's position, they're saying so long as the defendant requested it, no matter what it was, whether it was right, wrong, at the time, whatever, if they requested it, waiver. And that can't be the law. Because does that mean every time a defendant proposes or submits an alternative version of a model instruction based on what the law is at the time, that they're waiving any issue with that instruction? Any issue with the law at the time waived forever simply because they requested it, or they requested a similar instruction that may or may not have been given? That's going to discourage defense counsel from ever requesting any jury instruction. That by doing so, they're going to waive forever any issue that they may not have seen or that may not even be clear from the law at the time. And that can't be the law. The invited error doctrine can't so broadly supplant the Supreme Court's clear explication of what is waiver and what is forfeiture, and making clear that waiver requires, whether it's invited, acceded to, not objected to, it requires an intentional relinquishment of a known right. Here we didn't have that. There's no evidence in the record that was the case, and in fact it was not, because the controlling law at the time was such as it was. Thank you to the court, and we renew our request that the convictions be set aside.
Thank you, counsel. We thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10:25 a.m.
Court stands in recess until 10:25.